Hi, everyone. Welcome to the BizDev Podcast, the podcast about developing your business. I'm David Baxter, your host, and I am joined today, as usual, by Gary Voigt, who, little known fact, you know all those garden gnomes that sit out in front of your house? Gary makes those out of his trailer. He's got a little manufacturing plant right there next to his trailer in between the flamingos. How's that business going for you there, Gary?
Well, I'm selling the manufacturing plant. I put that on Craigslist. I'm now in the market for a 3D printer. And I'm hoping to kind of
cheaper than
more
the resin.
Up to date with my gnomon. I call them
your gnomon. That's nice.
Nomenclature for gnomes is gnomon.
Did you just say nomenclature? I can't hold a straight face for that. Come on.
My goodness.
Come on. That was painful. More importantly, we are joined by Benjamin Johnson, who is the founder of Particle 41. And we're going to talk to him about all sorts of goodies. I wanted to start because I think – now, correct me if I'm wrong, Benjamin, but when I've read a little bit about you, Particle 41 is a development shop. Is that accurate?
That's right. Yeah, end-to-end awesome. Product consultancy. Yep.
So you do what we do. That's what Big Pixel is. So that's very interesting. And I'm now I'm extra intrigued. So I wanted – because of that, I wanted to – but you're based in Dallas, right?
That's, I am.
What part of Dallas? I grew up in Dallas. So what part of Dallas?
I'm in Frisco. I'm in the hoity-toity part of Dallas. Yeah.
I grew up in Plano, so I totally understand the hoity-toity. Yeah. For those who don't know, Dallas is one of those places where you have to get fully dressed up and put on your best to go to the grocery store. It's just how it works.
And you get to use the valet. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a piano. This is not
a grocery store.
I'm not kidding. There is a grocery store when I was growing up. I think it was a Kroger Signature, which was their fancy brand, right? That actually had a piano in the middle of it, and there was someone playing it in the grocery store.
So now the new hotness is HEB. We got a couple HEBs here that everyone's lining up around the block for. So
HEB is a Houston brand, which was the discount mid-tier Houston grocery store. What's funny about that is in North Carolina, where I am, Bluebell is the fancy ice cream because they don't have that here. And so to me, growing up, Bluebell is out of Texas and it's the cheapo ice cream. And their number one ingredient is skim milk as opposed to cream. So it's, but people here are like, oh, Bluebell's the best ever. Okay, man, to each his own. Anyway, I'm sorry. I went off into a rabbit hole there, but a little extra for you Dallasites or people who are thinking about moving to Dallas. So let me think here. So Particle 41, you guys are a development shop. So I thought a really good intro topic would be hiring because I am guessing that your hiring is similar to our hiring, which means it's a hot mess. Are you guys U.S. based? You offshore? How do you guys get your people?
Yeah, so we're 100 people all across the globe, about 60 of which are based in India. One of my partners in the business is an Indian national. He's the CTO of the company. And so he runs the boots on the ground operation in India. Probably wouldn't do it any other way. And then we have people in South America and then project managers, designers in the US.
Okay. So your PMs and your designers are US based, but all of your development is done offshore in some capacity.
It's about 60-40 is about the split between nearshore and offshore.
Okay. Just correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't have any US based developers, right? They're all either South America or India, or did I miss anything?
I have some US based DevOps people. We have a big DevOps practice here. So yeah, we have a couple and, I have a rate card for all markets. So if that's what folks want, we would totally add that. It depends on the situation, but, predominantly, offshore, for the cost savings mostly.
Sure. So we are US based. That's a thing of ours. All of our people are US based, and which creates all sorts of weirdness. But they're all over the place. They're all remote. None of them are in North Carolina except for one project manager. Gary is in Florida, for instance. So I'm curious what it's like. I mean, because I don't know anything about offshoring specifically because I've never managed one. What is the hiring like? Like when you, I mean, there's a bazillion devs over there in India specifically is what I'm thinking of. I mean, there's just a lot. They crank them out of the colleges. There's just a lot of them there, which is awesome. And that's where they've got so much out. I remember looking years ago guy was his, he had a doctorate in development, and he, his bill rate, now again, this was a long time ago, was like $20. I was like, dude, that's crazy. Now I know they're a little more pricey now, but how do you find someone? Are you involved in that, or is that your CTO, or is it now even further away?
Well, sure. So we have a, some HR in-house. I mean, we have to take care of our people, and we're north of 60 people. So we have to have both an internal and a recruiting. There's been some cycles here. So when we were in COVID, obviously kind of hiring froze. And then when we came out into the Great Resignation. One thing I'll mention just about the type of business, this boutique consultancy, I've seen lower attrition rates in the boutique consultancies than I did in my clients' companies. And I think this distinction is really interesting. So we really focus on the craft of DevOps, or the craft of software development. And this connects directly to the developer's career, right? As a developer, I want to get better at development. I want to be presented with new and interesting problems. I don't want to get stale in my learning. And so we embrace that as a cultural internally. So while you might be focused on Acme Inc.'s new mobile app that they're doing, you're also seeing, we had 31 engagements in the last 12 months. So each one of our individual developers are able to kind of understand different technology choices and different things that are going on in these other businesses. And then we're able to take that back to the hive mind of what it means to be good developers, and deliver good products. So I think that has met the need of the individual a lot better than what you'd see at Acme Inc. At Acme Inc., they're worried about their share price, or they're worried about the revenue. So they have a trickle down of goals. Hopefully they're a well-run company and they have this trickle down of goals. And by the time you get down to the developer, it's okay, I need to do my project by X date. That's how I apply to this goal. This kind of like, this time pressure to deliver this thing by this certain date. And so there's this disconnect. The stock price relates to me so indirectly that, that the WIFM is lost sometimes for the developer. And then especially if we have a market condition like we do today and stock price is declining, then that's why you see a great resignation cycle in the client's company, but you didn't see it inside of Particle 41. Because we can really focus on that long-term skill of what it means to be a developer. So first off, we go into recruiting with that in mind, that we are craftsmen and that we are, that we have core values around building good products. And so I think that is those core values and those things that we're putting into the recruitment process is good. Now, we have had experiences with the emergence of ChatGPT. I know you guys, everybody's kind of wanting to talk about that lately. And we've seen people try to do interviews, or we at least have a strong gut feeling that they have tried to pass interviews using ChatGPT to assist them. So, so when somebody's reading things, you can kind of get a sense that they're reading things. So the pre-COVID, or going up into COVID, the interview process looked like this. It looked like, okay, we'll meet with one person for a kind of pseudo technical screening. The recruiter found you. There's some interest in working together. So we'll have you meet with one person for a technical screening, another person to maybe do a live coding exercise, another person. So we just saw that there was three or four steps to the interview process, and we were not getting really what we needed. So the standard that we set internally was a 1-hour technical screen that had to involve some type of screen share, working on code and making sure that the actual exercise was super simple, like loop over a list of dates, pick the odd ones. We did not pick a super challenging thing. But what we wanted to see is that they had an environment for development. They could set that up. They could talk to us about it. We could connect on things like, do you use VS Code or do you use something else? What extensions do you use? We could connect on this and really get a quick sense if this individual was one of us or not. And if we could make that connection in that 1 hour, then they were moved forward. If they struggled and we just couldn't make that connection, then they were rejected. But it's not going to work going forward to ask a bunch of technical questions, because you will have no idea what's going on their desktop. And we need to do all of this remotely, and we need to do it fast. So our, you know, kind of our secret sauce here that's not so secret anymore now is that it's a 1 hour technical screen, and it has to be some kind of shoulder to shoulder working session over some simple coding exercise. And we found that that really works. And you know, somebody with experience, it's not going to bother them one bit. Somebody who's struggling to get to that novice level in their career, obviously, is not going to want to do that. We find that, you know, the real high expertise guy, like the doctor you recommended, he probably is like, could you give me something a little harder to work on? But it's really about making that connection about what it means to be a developer. And once that connection's made, we're pretty happy, and we know we can work through the rest.
It's so interesting. Your process is a lot like our process, where we hire remotely, of course, and we have been hosed in so many creative ways that we have had to come up with a very similar process that you're talking about. Because we would have, and generally we find a lot of our people starting out as contractors, and then we bring them on after we've proven them out. Not always, but that's one way we've hired people. And when we hire contractors initially, man, I can't tell you my favorite one. And Gary, stop me if I've told this story before on the podcast. My favorite one recently was a guy says the picture of the guy looked like me, bald dude, white guy, you know, beard, you know, melon head, strangely similar looking to me. And he gets on, and at first he says he doesn't have a camera, which is to me is a no-go. I was like, okay, well, let me know when you do have a camera. And he's like, okay, let me go find one. So a minute later, he comes back. Finally, his camera comes on, and he's in a tank top undershirt, mm-hmm. which is always a good sign. And then his face is that picture avatared onto his face. So when it moved, it was super creepy because the mouth couldn't keep up with the with the speaking, and his voice didn't match either. He had a much more light voice than a guy my size would have, and it was just the strangest interview. He went through the whole thing like dead serious, that this was really him and this is how I should hire him. That's my favorite one of these. But we've had it all over. We've had people who said, oh yeah, I'm the coder. And then we find out that they're actually a front for another team somewhere else.
So you're saying he was not a cat. Have you seen that? I'm not a cat. I'm not a cat. I promise you I'm not a cat. Yeah.
That was like a political guy, right? Where he had
it was a courtroom. Yeah. It was a courtroom. And one of the attorneys or the judge or somebody was logging in as a cat. Yeah.
The cat was even better than this. But what was really scary, and when I talked to Gary about it afterwards, is in probably 2 or 3 years, that avatar will be so good I won't be able to tell. Yeah, that's what really scares me.
Meta avatars. You won't know for sure.
Well, but then I'll just ask him to show me their feet, and then it's over, right? Because they have no feet in Meta. So that'll be one of our new requirements, is to show me your feet. But we've gotten to the point where we have to do side-by-side coding and all of that to prove they are who they say they are. So it's interesting that you have gone through a similar thing. I do want to back up, because I want to talk about Particle 41. You have a very similar – your company's almost as old as mine. So I mean, you started 6 months after I did, according to your LinkedIn. I started – 10 years ago, March, and you started like 6 months after that. So our trajectory is very time-wise. My company is much smaller than yours, but it is really interesting to me. Did you start alone, or did you start immediately with a partner?
I've actually, in the past, I've been kind of a two-headed monster. So at the same time I was building Particle, I was also the CTO of a company called LegalInc. And then in 3 years, I sold it to LegalZoom. So I like working on a product. Now, since April of last year, I've been solely working on Particle and really growing our service capabilities We mostly grow through referral. That's the way we've grown since the beginning. So people in my network that I've well served, we're ran by four CTOs. So my partner offshore is CTO. I've been a CTO in the past. And so have my two of my other partners in the business. And so we have kind of a body of knowledge in different backgrounds. Our networks, you know, we did good work for folks in the past. They go somewhere else and we set up those teams as well. We're really indexed on, you know, technical partnership, where we're kind of the engineering team in a box or product dev team, for businesses. So we can do CTO advisory, product ownership, design, and then of course the table stakes software dev, project management, QA. DevOps is a big thing that I'm into, and have been into for a long time. It's just the idea of really getting the most out of your cloud. And then we also have a data engineering practice as well. So very technically diverse and kind of wide on the different skill sets. But what we really focus is that team environment, and whether that's a team that we're augmenting or we're kind of providing a turnkey team for the client.
So when you started 9.5 years ago or something like that, was it just you, or is it you and the four other CTOs that you happen to know?
The original founding team was myself and my offshore partner.
Okay. So you guys had an idea because you guys knew each other in some capacity outside of that. You're like, hey, can make an amazing dev company together. And so were you ever a dev yourself, or you were just DevOps guy? What was your career path? What were you bringing to the table?
Yeah, back in 2001, after college, feel like I've been programming since I was in junior high, kind of, so I could go way back with some of my early programming stuff. But yeah, I built an online travel company, so before Orbitz, before 9/11, and grew that to about 70 million. So interacting with mainframe GDS systems to deliver discounted travel rates to the internet before anybody was doing that. And that early experience in online travel was a lot of coding, but also a lot of racking and stacking hardware and doing it all very grassroots. So learned a ton through that process, and picked up Ruby on Rails shortly thereafter. Really loved that. Did a couple of media companies using Ruby. So yeah, I definitely like to get my hands on some code once in a while.
So you were you're a serial entrepreneur, which I knew that, and you build up, sell, build up, sell, build up, sell. So you've been building product companies. What made you decide instead to do a consulting firm kind of setup?
The service company is really the call out to that expertise and that craftsmanship. And I really love the exposure to multiple products at the same time, multiple challenges at the same time. I think the advantage to not only myself, but also my team is we just get to see a lot more than what you would see if you were working within the constraints of a single company. So I like working in the entrepreneurial side because you get to do all these things like learn how to hire people, learn how to sell your services, learn how to report your finances and do all the fun back office stuff. That business acumen, as I grow is also super interesting. The best way to do leadership and the best way to do all of those business acumen type things. But being able to see what's working technologically and tactically for folks is also super intriguing. And then as I work with clients, I get really involved in their product, who is their ICP? How are they listening to their ICP and, you know, working towards that feedback rather than working off of their own assumptions? So I just simply cannot separate the product side from the service side of my brain. I'm always kind of operating in both, because the worst thing is to write a beautiful piece of code and nobody use it.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah, we talk about when we work with startups a lot, that's a big drumbeat that we do a lot is simply, you know, you're going to turn this on and no one's going to care. We call that the slog. When you turn this on, your job is now to make people care. And that's a, that can be months or years, but this is going to be the hardest part of your startup right there, because it is a soul crushing when you've worked so hard on something and no one cares. That's fine. That's normal. Don't freak out. They will care if you keep at this, is kind of our mantra.
Yeah. Because
it is sad. You build it. It's awesome. And no one, and they fold shop because they ran out of steam. That's heartbreaking for us.
Yeah. If you build it, they will come is a fallacy of the startup. You have to generate interest. And we kind of lost track of that as the VC bubble was created. I call it a bubble because I think we just saw it burst. VC money was so plentiful for so long that if we rewind back to just before that happened, there was this great body of work around bootstrapping. And mm-hmm. bootstrapping was this idea of maybe I have this, I'm seeing this need in the marketplace. Maybe I want to create a product for it. How can I validate this idea? And so people were putting out like a little ebook or a little white paper and putting that out on the net to see if they could get some interest in that. And then understanding like an early set of ICP and starting to draw feedback. And I think those folks we need to kind of go back to what those folks documented and pull that back up and go, okay, well now in 2023 with capital being so expensive, this is what we got to get back to, of validating ideas and seeing what kind of traction we can get. The also great thing about a services company is you can make money right away, whereas a product company generally has that build tail or some kind of risky investment. And so we need to reduce the risk of that initial investment and get back into a more minimalistic self-funding approach. And reduce that risk for not only ourselves, but our investors. And then I think as we come out of the slump, those two things will connect.
We push really hard on the concept of bootstrapping. And because once you go investment, you can never go back to bootstrapping, but you can always go to investment, is what we tell our clients all the time. You know, see, and it also changes your outlook. If you're paying the bills out of either your own funds or, you know, family, friends kind of thing, you're going to be thinking about revenue way, way sooner than if you have a 2-year runway that some investor hands you, right?
Right.
We want you to think about revenue early, early, early on, because it's going to change how you run your company from day one. We've seen so many startups that we've worked with and others that say, I'm going to go on the user acquisition route, which it always makes me shake my head a little bit because that rarely works. I mean, even Twitter, perfect example. They weren't profitable for 12 years, and I'm not sure they're ever going to be profitable again. I mean, that user acquisition route is really hard. Now, the gold at the end of the rainbow is that if you nail it, it's almost infinite money. Facebook, Google, I mean, all of these live on the fact that they have tapped into the ultimate spigot of infinite money, because you can always sell data. And you can always advertise. If you figure that out, it's really hard. People don't give those companies enough credit that they have solved something that has never been solvable before. It is every other company in the history of the planet that I can think of, correct me if I'm wrong, they sell a product. And now we have companies that literally don't have a product. They sell their users. Very different world. And it's totally backwards.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, since when have you heard of a SaaS company being a lifestyle company for the founders, right? The idea is that you drive up the value and you raise as much money as you can, and then you go public. By the time you go public, you know, your original founder probably owns a single digit of equity. Mm-hmm. And so to me, maybe being a touch more modest about the growth trajectory, being okay with growing to, I'll just use 100 million as a goal reference point, you know, getting to 100 million in ARR being this kind of like fantastic goal. What if that takes a little bit longer, but you can actually have margin and actually have profit throughout that journey? I think that is something that founders need to kind of think about. rather than being so impatient and selling equity to the hilt, you know, to try to hit that goal in just some kind of record unicorn pace. I think if we do that, we'll the differences between a product company and a services company are going to kind of reduce. And I'm also super interested in this idea of a tech-enabled service where you've done a service so well and you start to add technology around that. And then that becomes a tech-enabled service. I guess you could argue Uber as an example, as the favorite example of almost everyone, is a tech-enabled service. It's a two-sided marketplace, but just for a moment, let's just say that all Uber drivers were kind of not this independent contractor anomaly, but they were all part of, you know, a single company brand. You could literally do something like that, making money off of every transaction, off of every ride, and just make it better and better by optimizing it through technology. Probably a bad example, but the tech-enabled services are really cool too, because you may have something that is a service cost. And I think we're seeing that with kind of like data entry things, that then you can start to automate those services and make them more and more affordable to produce. But that doesn't necessarily mean the customer is willing to pay less. Sure. So those can be really great opportunities too.
You bring up something interesting that I'd never really thought about before. I miss the idea of a regional company. I'm old, and that used to be a thing where, you know, you started a brand, you're an entrepreneur, and you create a hardware store or whatever, you know, 20 years ago, whatever you were building. And if you did really well, you'd open up a few more, and you'd open up a few more. And then suddenly you might have 6, 10, 12 of your gizmos around the state. But someone in California, 1,000 miles away from you, have no idea you exist. And they had the same thing, and they built up their own 12, 15 stores. And both of these people are wildly successful, and they're doing very well. The concept of Uber, you could do that on a regional basis. And in fact, it used to be. There used to be dozens of ride sharing and scooter companies and this, that, and the other. But now everything is national. And so they get so big that there's no way that you can have a regional version of that. Like a regional scooter company, right? That doesn't exist. It can't, because you can never get that scale. And I kind of miss that, if I'm being honest. I wish we could get back to that to a point. I mean, I'm not saying we need a regional Facebook, but some companies, I think, you'd get better service. Your profits would make more sense. People would know your drivers, that kind of thing. I don't know. I'm off in the weeds there, but it's just, I kind of miss that. I'm old enough to remember that was a thing.
You can combine your love for grocery store valets and Uber and make regional grocery store valet companies.
Man, dude, where's my notebook?
We have write that down and mail it to ourselves for a copyright. Yeah. That's
right. Just wear it everywhere. I've been having this stuck to me for years. It's my idea. Anyway.
Well, Ben, we do have one question we ask every guest, and you kind of started to touch on it a little bit in your last answer. So just to expand on that, what are three pieces of advice that you would give an entrepreneur or a new business or a startup when entering the market?
Yeah, I think to echo what we already talked about is start small, you know, and have a little bit of patience about validating your idea and trying to learn from your user, you know, connect with your user and figure out their need. I really suggest for folks to think about the service that they actually want to provide first before they think about the product, and lean, at least with the way the market is right now, lean towards, say you have this ICP, you know, one of the big problems in trucking right now is if you break down as a truck driver, there's no mobile mechanic so let's say we're going to grow this business. My recommendation to that kind of entrepreneur would be, don't try to create a two-sided marketplace product from day one. Try to figure out who's that truck driver broken on the side of the road and what their problem is. And if you have to hire somebody to answer that phone call and fix that problem for them completely analog or manually, do that first. You know, feel solve the problem for your ICP as much before the technology, because the moment that you start paying companies like me to build companies like mine to build that proc for you, you are you're investing. You've become an investor in your own idea. But if you can actually start solving the problem, pick up the phone, call the mobile mechanics for them, get somebody out there, and then figure out a way to make money in that transaction, then you're headed down a road of a tech-enabled service. And I think right now that's the way people need to be thinking. Two-sided marketplaces is what most of the ideas I hear are, some form of two-sided marketplace. And they're very difficult. You have to build towards not only the person receiving the service, but you also have to build towards the vendor. And so from day one, you're like, all your resources and all your capital is split two ways. And you have to make these decisions. Do I want to work on the supply or address the demand? And you can't separate those two in your mind. So you immediately take on this huge responsibility. And I don't know if you truly understand the problem that you're trying to solve. So that's all in that vein of start small, serve the customer, care about your ICP. And I think that's a really good way right now, especially with capital being expensive, to reduce your risk and actually maybe even make a dollar from the first day, rather than waiting till you've put a bunch of money into a bucket, created a product, and then you have also then, like we discussed, have to then figure out how to market that product in two directions, towards the, towards the supply vendors and towards the demand. The other thing I would say is kind of stepping out of the grind is don't forget to take care of yourself, exercise, take care of your family. These are marathon deals. Like, growing a business is a marathon. It is not a sprint. And the people you want at the finish line are super important to kind of pull along the way. So, you know, there's a certain amount of discipline that I feel is really important to us as humans. You know, don't sacrifice sleep for your idea. There's so much of this kind of grind culture. And believe me, it's super important to be driven and work hard. And I'll be right there with folks. You know, I have been definitely accused of some workaholic tendencies by my wife and my family. But the idea of this being a marathon is super important. And just making sure that your body keeps up with you should not be ignored, no matter how good you think your idea is, or no matter how much an hour is worth to you. You got to kind of maintain some good personal habits.
Yeah, I like that. We've actually talked about the validation of the idea in past episodes, and David had a story about connecting a tourist to a photographer in that city, and then doing the legwork on your own, kind of connecting them to make that, just to see if that's a viable service. So that was great. And then the anti-hustle culture is also something we kind of talked about, I would say, two or three times at least, about not overworking yourself to death just because of the hustle culture tells you to, you know? So,
yeah, I think the flip side of that too is also like this, as much as the hustle culture is something I would love to warn people about, because, like, you know, your kids are only young once and all of that, but the opposite's also true. Like, we have these procrastination aids in our pockets here, and we can go flip reels for 30 minutes and just screen suck our lives away. And so the time management is just super important. Like, you know, Instagram's not on my phone right now, just because I think, you know, for me, I needed to do some reprogramming, some detoxing there. And so just watch the screen sucking, because you don't get that time back either. And so, like, just kind of evaluating the value of every moment, I think, is super critical for an entrepreneur. And I think the discussion we have internally is, are we resting or are we recreating? Because recreation might not be rest. What you might be wanting is rest, but what you're doing instead is recreating, and that's not the same thing. So I'm all for a little reduction in recreation, increase of rest, And then that way you can maximize your productivity time.
Man, I couldn't echo that more. I have removed myself from almost all social media for exactly that reason. You can just fall down a hole and wake up, it's an hour gone, and all you saw was 3,000 videos of a puppy doing something funny, which is right. Always great. Don't get me wrong, but yeah, that's, man. And what's, it's easy to recognize that when you're 40 plus years old, but to tell my kids that, yeah, mm-hmm. they think I'm crazy. That's, this is life.
Yeah, my kids are mad at me because I won't install that Game Pigeon app or whatever and play games with them throughout the day or whatever. I'm like, no, I have things to do. The last thing I want to do is play Battleship on my text messages with you. Like
the dad talk that I have inside my house is we need to create instead of consume. And I just kind of say that a million times. Now they even probably are shadow miming me while I'm not looking. You got to create instead of consume, you know, like it just,
they got a whole TikTok channel making fun of it.
Yeah, exactly. I would much, much rather see my 9-year-old draw or do something that's creating something, than have him spend an hour watching YouTube reels. So, hopefully that will get through at some point. Hopefully I say it enough, they'll never forget that. But the idea of creating, even if you're just recording your video game footage and throwing it up on YouTube to see if that's interesting to someone, that's at least, creating something. You're showing something for your time. And so I think even an exchange like that is going to be valuable because you're even thinking of your video game time as a means to create content. And so trying to get them to think of the creation aspect of it, what they're doing and the value of it is, I think, super important.
I like that. Love create it. Instead of consume. Now, Ben, if anybody wanted to reach out to get to know you more or get to know more about Particle 41, how could they get in touch?
They can reach out to me directly. I'm ben@particle41.com. And they can also get me on LinkedIn. I'm Benjamin R. Johnson on LinkedIn.
All right. We'll include those links in our show notes. They'll be under the video here on YouTube and also throughout whatever podcast distribution you use. They'll be in the show notes for this.
Awesome.
And if anybody wants to reach out and get in touch with us or leave any comments or questions, you can do that again under this video on YouTube, or you can email us at hello@thebigpixel.net. You can get all our links for social media. We are on all channels, including TikTok, where we're going to watch funny reels of Ben getting made fun of by his kids. But
hey, and don't forget to review us on Apple Podcasts. That's important. Review us on Apple Podcasts. It's funny how that little site, everyone listens to on all sorts of different gizmos, but Apple Podcasts still wins. For I guess it's just because of the default, but that helps a lot for people to discover the show. So review us.
All right, and with that, thanks again, and we'll see you guys next week.
Have a good one, everybody.
Thank you.